So now we have time for some more questions. And still not that many questions, which shows you are being peaceful. Or you're just half asleep, one of the two. Probably peaceful. Uh-oh. The first question starts with whoops. I broke the noble silence. Whispering the Dhamma, one becomes a motor mouth when it comes to the Dhamma. I acknowledge it and ask for forgiveness. So should you do a penance first of all? What penance can you do? No, remember one of the nice things about Buddhism, we don't have penances, we don't have guilt trips. So if you broke the noble silence, what do you mean by noble silence? I've told you many times in this retreat, what it really means is you don't have a bell to wake up in the morning, you don't have a bell to sort of have to sit, you don't have a bell to go to sleep. It's no bell silence. You've heard that before, but you still groan. But real noble silence is just talking at the right time. So it doesn't mean you don't talk at all. You know, if there's something to say, say it, if it's really important. So the usual rule is, before you open your mouth and say something, you contemplate three times. The first time you contemplate, you think, is it really necessary that you speak? And if it passes that first test, yes, it's really necessary. Then you go on to the second question. Is it really, really necessary? And if you tick that box too, yes, it's really, really necessary, then you can go to box number three. Surprise, surprise. Is it really, really, really necessary? And if you think, it is really, really, really necessary, you thought about it three times and open your mouth and speak. It's important. For example, there might be like a snake crawling up the back of your chair. And that's really, really, really important. So tell them, hey, there's a snake coming up the back of your chair. So don't say, oh, I've got to keep noble silence and start making... By the time they understand what you're doing, the snake's bit them. So there's a difference between stupid silence and noble silence. Stupid silence is when you make all these hand signals or you write on pieces of paper and give it to a person. That's stupid silence. Noble silence is most of the time you keep quiet. When there's something to say, you just say it without getting into a conversation. And some of you might be looking for their glasses. You say, your glasses are over there. Or looking for their shoes. Shoes are over there. That's not breaking a noble silence. That's silence which is noble. But obviously, if you start to say, oh, your shoes are over there, you shouldn't put them over there, you should put them over here, then that's not noble silence at all. That's getting into a conversation. So it's all right to speak just a few words every now and again. And if you do just get into a chat with somebody, you know, you all know me, I'm a very compassionate monk, and I'm not a compassionate monk on purpose. It is because that there's too much guilt in our societies. You know, you have these rules, and when you break the rule, you think you need a sort of some penalty or penance. And some of you won't know that story. Many years ago, there was an Anagarika over at Bodhinyana Monastery, and they came to confess to me. They hadn't just broken their noble silence. They'd broken their precepts. They'd gone into the kitchen in the afternoon and they'd made themselves a sandwich. Now, this is not a suggestion to you visitors and Anagarika sitting in the back over there. They did this, and so they felt so bad, they came to me to confess. I did a terrible thing. I broke my precepts. In the afternoon, when I'm not supposed to eat, I went into the kitchen. No one saw me. I made a sandwich. I feel so bad about that. And of course, you know what I say, very good, you acknowledge your mistake, and you know, you told me, that's excellent. Now, Just, you know, do some strategies. Eat more at lunchtime so you don't feel so hungry. And if you are hungry, have some apple juice or orange juice. Have some chocolate or something. So you don't need to break your precepts. So it will help you keep your precept in the future. Okay, now you can go. And this Anagarika said, that's not good enough. Said, I need some sort of penance or punishment, because if I don't get a penance or punishment, he said, I know my character, I'll do it again. So he put me on the spot. And it just happened that that morning I was reading a book. I still remember the book. It was by Robert Hughes or something Hughes, The Fatal Shore. It's a story of the early history of Australia. And I've been reading some of the things they did to those convicts in those early days. You know, they flogged them, you know, with these cat of nine tails. And I just read that. And I thought, you want a punishment. I will give you a traditional Australian punishment. I'll give you 50 strokes of the cat. And I never forget this Anagarika's face. It went, you know, whiter than the clothes he was wearing. Because he didn't really understand what a Buddhist monastery was all about. And he thought, oh my God, what have I asked for? Ajahn Brahm's going to flog me. And then I told him what 50 strokes of the cat mean in a Buddhist monastery. We have two cats now. Find either one of them and stroke them 50 times. One, two. So that's 50 strokes of the cat. Learn some compassion and kindness. Because you do learn a lot of compassion and forgiveness when you stroke a cat. I said, that's what your penance, 50 strokes of the cat. And if you do it again, I'll give you 100 strokes of the cat. We don't have penance. So unfortunately, we don't have a cat in this retreat center yet, although the caretakers threatened to get a rabbit, so I hear on the grapevine. Yeah, I know what goes on. So, just if you can't find a cat or a rabbit, just stroke yourself. One, two, three, four. I'm okay, never mind. So that way we have forgiveness, because forgiveness means we let go of the past. We don't have any holding on to the past with wanting to take revenge and hurt someone else or hurt ourselves. All this hurting of others and hurting ourselves, revenge and guilt has no part in Buddhism whatsoever. So please forgive yourself as you forgive other people. I don't know how many people already are really upset at the people who you share the cottage with. Banging the doors. Getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning when you want to get up at 5 o'clock. Rattling their keys. Just flushing the toilet. Snoring or whatever. Because usually just, you know, you've got your own room. Your own space. But still people can disturb you. And so, don't get angry at people. And don't get angry at yourself. Please forgive everybody. So if you have broken the noble silence, actually you haven't. It was, what you were doing was okay. It was noble silence, not stupid silence by speaking. So you don't need to ask forgiveness at all. People sometimes ask forgiveness at the end of a retreat. But many of you know I've already given you forgiveness, because whenever I give forgiveness, I give forgiveness in the three time zones. I give people forgiveness whatever they've done in the past. I give people forgiveness whatever they're doing in the present. And I give you forgiveness whatever you might ever do in the future. So you're pre-forgiven. You've got blank check. You do whatever you want, you're already forgiven. Pre-forgiven. I think that's a lovely thing to do. Because that's what my father said, the door of my heart's open to you, son, no matter what you ever do. It was that unconditional love, it was a blank check for me. He would forgive me no matter what I did. He pre-forgave me. I thought it was a wonderful gesture I got from my father. And if I valued that from my father to me, I'll pass it on to you. So whatever any of you do during this retreat, you're already pre-forgiven. You got blank check. Because I trust you and respect you. So, that's the first question. Dear Ajahn, I can't seem to be able to give up the controller. I've tried to be a watcher, but when shooing away past and future thoughts, control invariably comes back. I'm guessing that As a result of the above, plus knee aches that arise every 20 minutes like clockwork, can't seem to experience a breath. Naturally, advice will be much appreciated. Desperate and meta. They didn't say desperate, but you know what it's like sometimes. That's what it's like sometimes in a meditation retreat. You sort of understand, but you can't really understand, and it gets frustrating or whatever. So, the reason you can't give up the controller is because you're trying to give up the controller. It's just another type of controlling. Trying to control the controller, and trying to control the controlling of the controller. And you just get so stuffed up in the head trying to do this. So that's why, instead of saying, let go of the controller, just make peace. No matter what you're experiencing right now, you're tired, you're frustrated, you're bored, you're just going out of your mind. You know, going crazy is not against the 8 precepts. So just go crazy. So you know that if you allow yourself to go crazy, you don't go crazy at all. So you make peace with this. Make peace with it means you don't go to war with things. You don't fight them. You don't, you know, like even in Christianity, you know, you turn the other cheek. You know, give me more craziness. So that is always of just making peace, which means giving up. Because people say, how do you let go? Making peace is one of the great ways of letting go. One of the second ways of letting go is being kind. No revenge, no anger. That's let go of everything which happened in the past. It's wonderful when you don't have to seek revenge, when you don't have to punish yourself or other people. All the business of the past is gone. There's nothing you have to do with the past. The only reason the past keeps on coming up to you is because of guilt or anger. You just want this unfinished business, things which you feel you have to do. So the past keeps coming up. When you give up guilt, which is trying to punish yourself, and you give up anger, which is trying to punish other people, yeah, sure, they deserve it, but don't worry about it. As I keep on saying, I did this saying, and I hoped it would get in one of the calendars. You know these calendars, we're printing BSWA calendars now, and you have my sayings, but this saying got canned. I don't know why it got canned, because it's a great saying of mine. No need to seek revenge, because karma will get the bastards anyway. I don't know why that wasn't put in the calendar. You understand what I mean? That's an Australian saying, but you know you understand in Singapore as well and Malaysia. So well, you don't need to seek revenge. You know, karma will get them. So you can just totally let it go and leave it to karma to do the dirty work. And you can just do the nice work. You can be kind and compassionate because you know that karma will get those bastards. Because you can just be kind and compassionate. And, and that way, sort of, you're giving up the control. You're just being kind. And the other one is just being this wonderful gentleness. So yeah, when you do get into a sort of, you know, difficult situation and your mind is going crazy, be gentle with your mind. There, it's all right, mind. You can be crazy. You can be tired. You can be mad. Just be so gentle. And then patience shows you, this too will pass. This too will pass. And that's something which you all know. Most of you have been to these retreats before. You all know this is par for the course. First couple of days, you're getting settled into the retreat. It takes a while for the mind just to get the hang of the retreat and get into the atmosphere and stop doing the old things it used to do outside and start to do this Dhamma way of thinking. You just can't just say, I'm going to stop controlling, because that's more controlling. You just, controlling gets less and less and less and less until it totally stops. It just happens naturally as you ease into this retreat. So don't worry about it. You won't be able to give up the controller. Basically, the controller gives you up. So it just stops. So you don't need to worry about things. And as for your knee aches that arise every 20 minutes like clockwork, see if you can get one of these clocks which goes slow. So you get an extra 5 minutes. Put some sort of dead batteries in your clock. Or whatever it is. And
sit on a chair if you want to. Or sit like the gentleman over there. Well done. Sit with your legs out. That's what we've got walls for, to lean against. So lean against the wall with your feet out. And if you feel embarrassed about doing that, a piece of advice I should have given in the early days, your room is like your cave. You don't have to meditate in this hall. You've got these beautiful rooms, and they're safe, and you're by yourself, and no one is going to sort of disturb you inside your room. So meditate inside your room. It's a beautiful place to meditate. So you have solitude. So if you want to meditate here, meditate in this room, or meditate in your own room. You can meditate on the stupa, like I've seen people meditating on the stupas, or go into the bush somewhere and meditate, but the bush has got too many little creepy crawlies and ants and stuff get on you. But there's lots of places where you can just sit down and meditate and have a wonderful time. You don't have to meditate in here. And when you're meditating in your room, you can put your legs out and get yourself really comfortable. And that way your knees won't ache, and that way that you won't have that sort of problem. And usually when the body gets really relaxed and the meditation starts to bite, you start to get still, you'll find an amazing thing happens. When you really relax the body, the aches disappear. They just don't come up. They're tension aches. And after a while, when the body gets really loose, you don't tend to have those aches. You sit in meditation, where's the aching knees gone? They're gone. Simply because you've relaxed. So that's an easy problem to solve. So just put your legs out. Be kind to yourself. And if they really keep coming back, retreat after retreat, get them amputated. That'll solve the problem. That's a bit extreme. Dear Bhante, are there specific strategies, tips to counteract the five hindrances in early stages of meditation, apart from being at peace, kind, gentle and patient? Many merits to you for your guidance and compassion. Yeah, it's easy, I think. Okay, instead of making peace, being kind, being gentle, being patient, try being patient, being gentle, being kind and being peaceful. Try it the other way. Because basically, it's all the same. It's all like letting go and making things be. I'm going to talk about the five hindrances tomorrow, but just to give you the preview, just learn to accept and be content. If a hindrance is coming up, welcome, hindrance. Thank you for coming to visit me. I'm sleeping. Ah, thank you, sleepiness and sloth and torpor. You're a great friend of mine. And just be kind to the sloth and torpor. Welcome it in, instead of fighting it. I don't want to be sleepy. I don't want to be dull. I want to have jhana. I don't want to be dull. Don't be a whinger like that. It's dullness comes in. Oh, dullness, lovely. Because a lot of people don't like dullness. So imagine what dullness feels like. No one likes me, no one loves me. So dullness has got sort of this psychological problem of no one liking me. So when dullness, you know, I always like to stick up for the people who are badly treated. So when dullness comes, oh, welcome. You know, no one else loves you, but I love you, dullness. So be compassionate to poor old dullness. And restlessness, your mind all over the place. Oh, it doesn't matter, restlessness is okay. Even the Buddha was restless before he became enlightened. All the people become enlightened. So this must be a cause of enlightenment. So welcome restlessness. So when you welcome these things in, door of my heart's open to you, restlessness. Come right in. And then you're not feeding these things. When you welcome them, just restlessness, gee. She understands me, and restlessness will go and bother someone else. Just like when a ghost comes. Ooh, ooh, ooh. And you say, oh, come here, ghost. How are you doing? And then ghost thinks, she's not afraid of me, so she'll go into the cottage next door. Ooh, ooh.
Because what the only fun a ghost has is making people scared. It's really boring for a ghost if you don't get scared. So the same with restlessness. You know, when you don't react to restlessness, it just disappears and vanishes. So let's welcome restlessness. What are the other ones? Craving. Craving, come. And when you do that, sort of, you don't sort of feed the craving. And ill will. Ah, ill will. Be kind to ill will. Because that's another person, a being in the mind who feels totally rejected. It's like this little monster, this little Nazi who comes into your mind, ill will. You say, ah, welcome ill will. It's amazing that when people are very violent, a tiny bit of kindness to them and they calm right down. So ill will is like a violent little enemy which comes into the mind, a monster. So you be kind to that monster, just like the demon in the emperor's palace. Welcome, ill will. Thank you for coming here. It totally undermines it. It can't last very long. Which is why when you have kindness to all of these things, they just vanish. And as for doubt, I'll just leave doubt till later on. And I will give a talk on the five hindrances tomorrow, so please make sure you don't have the five hindrances tomorrow morning when we talk about them. Otherwise, you won't remember what I say. Next one. Could you say something about the attitude of kindness and friendship towards the body? Yes, I can. Second question. That's my answer. Does this attitude relate to the body's natural functioning, including the activity of the five senses? Is this part of peace and acceptance of the present experience? Yeah, of course it is. So, the attitude of kindness and friendship towards the body, because you've seen so many people, they look upon the body as something to exploit. Just like, you know, in Western philosophy, animals were supposed to be at our service to exploit. And when you become a boss, people are there to exploit. And people have this idea of, like, you know, they're in power, they're in control, and everyone is at their service. And they take that to their body and their mind as well, that this is the place we have mastery over. I'm the mistress and the body is my servant. And people try and force their body that way. And of course the body reacts, it gets sick, it gets tense, it doesn't like you. So see what type of relationship you have with your body. Do you keep forcing it? Because sometimes I look at my body and I say, I apologize, body, because you know, you go on all these trips overseas and you have to really force it to give a talk when you're sick. The body wants to go to bed and people coming up ask you to sign their books or have photographs. And the poor old body gets a rough time when it gets overseas. But I say sorry to my body. And the first chance I have, I try and look after my body, give it a nice rest. So I've got this attitude to my body that, you know, I'm its best friend and I'm going to really look after my body. I'm not going to force it. Because every time I've forced it, that's when you sort of get tense, you feel the sickness, the possibility of sickness coming up. I'm quite amazed just how healthy I am as a monk. Many of the other monks are just always sick, the ones in my sort of position. But I really look after my body with kindness and care. And I just work it hard sometimes, but I always say sorry afterwards and try and look after and care for it. And by doing that, my body is pretty fit and healthy. So it's the same with you. Be kind to your body. Very often when I start meditating, I ask it, what do you want, body? What do you need? Especially after the, you know, the talks in the evening. I ask, what do you want, body? Do you want to meditate some more or do you want to sort of go to bed? So last night, it wasn't really quite sure. So I meditated for about 5 or 10 minutes and then it told me very clearly, no, no, I'm tired, go to bed. So I took my body to bed at 9:10. So just I asked my body and I listened to it. So you ask your body, body, what do you need? What do you want? And what your body tells you, you follow. You know, many times people tell me this. I remember reading a book upon heart disease. They say before a person has a heart attack, they have many signs, many, many signs. But people just don't listen because they don't want to listen to their body. The body's telling you, slow down, take a rest. But people don't listen to their body.
They think they're just going to sort of exploit their body and they have enough willpower, they're going to keep on going no matter what.
And eventually, people like that, they get the big heart attack and then they die. There's an old saying I heard a long time ago, death is nature's way of telling you to slow down.
It's a bit late by that time. But if you actually listen to your body, you actually know what it
needs to do. And sometimes, I can't predict, sometimes I've got huge amounts of energy, don't need to sleep much. And other times, I can't figure it out. Sometimes I just need to go to sleep. And so if that's what my body says, I don't care what time of the day it is. My body says, you go to sleep. And I listen and I follow suit. And that way your body feels really healthy and very fit. And it's easy to meditate. So by looking after the body that way, again, I've just been meditating for such a long time, I don't get sore knees. Now, I did have a back problem some time ago. That's totally gone as well. So my body's in pretty good shape. And the reason you do that is because I listen to my body. And I've got this friendship to my body, the sense of being a partner of mutual respect. And I don't tend to regard my body as a slave. So when you relate to the body like that, and you're caring for it, it cooperates with you. You don't get so many sicknesses, so many pains. So if my knees are aching, I'd move them. I'd sit on a chair. I'd do whatever it needs so my body is reasonably at ease, as much as I possibly can. So that's what you should do with your friendship towards the body. And that attitude of being a friend towards things means you're not a controller anymore. You have kids, you know, your daughter is your friend, not your daughter, so you don't try and control her. Now, your partner in life, this is a person you live with rather than your slave, always telling them what to do and trying to figure out a way to get whatever you want out of them. And the workers you have at the monastery, or at your office, I don't treat sort of Venerable Santuti like a slave, do I?
Say no, he doesn't say no, doesn't. Otherwise I'll hit you.
If you say I do, I'll hit you when I... No. So you don't treat people like slaves, you work with people. And this is actually the attitude you have to your bodies, the attitude you have to your friends and relations. And the best thing is the attitude you have to your mind. You don't treat your mind like a slave. You treat it like this friend. And so if your friend feels sick and the mind is going crazy, what do? You don't tell your friend, stop being crazy, pull yourself together, you stupid friend. You don't do that. If they're going crazy, you look after them and care for them. What do you need? You're sick. Can I give you something special? And if you treat your mind like that, your mind gets very healthy. And it can play with you. Why? Because it loves you. Why? Because you love it. Sometimes in meditation I call this like smiling at the mind. See, I smiled at you, you smile back. You have to do that. That's just what happens. You smile at the mind. And the mind smiles back. Hi. Which means your mind gets easier to watch. It becomes a friend. So often I do that, meditation is getting there, it's going dull, it's sort of peaceful, but it's not really biting in the meditation. Just smile at your mind. And the mind smiles back and then you get some joy coming up and then you're away. So it's a whole attitude, I think you've got it now. Being kind, being gentle, smiling at the mind, smiling at life, smiling at everything, smiling even at the hindrances. The hindrances smile back. Hi, Sothen Thorpa. Hi, Ajahnpa. And then there's no problem anymore. It's gone. Aside from noticing the lack of will anatta during walking meditation, what other ways of contemplating are there to develop insights while doing walking meditation? Just contemplate stillness, emptiness. You're completely wasting time doing walking meditation. Do the wasting time meditation. It's a great thing to waste time because most of things in life, we always do it to try and get something. Isn't that what are you here to waste time? Are you here to try to get something out of this meditation retreat? If you're trying to get something, you're wasting time. If you're wasting time, you actually get something. that's very true, because what actually happens
is when we're not trying to get somewhere, then we're actually here. When you want to get something, you're just not here anymore. You're way off in this future, in this goal, in this destination you're trying to reach, which means you're not right here. So when you're doing walking meditation, say, I am going to waste half an hour. This is wasting time meditation. Waste. Left foot, waste. Right foot, time. Waste time. Waste time. Waste time. And that means you sort of don't get any sort of goals or aspirations or expectations or desires. And then, you know, you get amazing things happen. Because when you stay where you are, when you're not trying to get anywhere, when you're more fully where you already are, that's where you see the Dharma, that's where you find peace. All the peace, enlightenment, jhanas, nimittas, insights are right here in this very moment. But we don't look long enough in this moment, we always look somewhere else. Anywhere else, rather than looking here. That's why present moment awareness when you're walking meditation. Just be in a moment and have no idea of what you're supposed to do next. The body knows how to walk. You've been doing it all your life. So just let the body do the walking and you just chill out. And as I say, you don't get anywhere. You're not meant to get anywhere. You're supposed to be here. So waste time. No goal. No expectation, no desire, nowhere to go, nothing to be. Just vanish. That's another way of doing walking meditation. But remember the one about I will die, that's for sure, that's a good one. A beautiful picture, someone lying on the steps of the stupa while a kangaroo is munching on the grass behind them. Yeah, so who was doing the meditation? The person lying on the steps or the kangaroo munching the grass? You can think about that one. Right. Dear Ajahn, can you clarify the difference between right effort and willpower in meditation? Is there an appropriate use of willpower in meditation? How can I use right effort to overcome negative states of mind and cultivate positive ones? There is a being in Buddhism called Mara, M-A-R-A. We built our city centre in the suburb of Nola Mara, which means, the Chief Reverend said that, Nola Mara. So it's a very, very significant place to build a centre, a place where there's no Mara. Because Mara, according to Buddhist cosmology, Mara is the chief, the head of the devas in the realm of the Paranimitta Vasavati realm, which is basically the realm of those who wield power over others' creations. This is control freak in chief, the ones who get off on controlling others. The big boss. And that's Mara. It is a symbol of the controller. Big time controlling. Which is why that Mara gets really pissed off at meditators. Why? Because they just let go of control. They go beyond Mara's reach. Which is why when Mara comes up, he says, control your mind. Stop the hindrances. Put forth effort. Do something. Come on, do something. And the way that the monks overcome Mara is all they say, I know you, Mara. I know you, controller. I know you, will. And then, according to the suttas, Mara droops his shoulders and looks glum and forlorn. The meditator knows me. The meditator knows me and just walks away despondent. You read that many times in the suttas. So that's actually how we overcome that effort and that will which comes from Mara. I know you, Mara. Straight off, just that recognizing what you're doing and recognizing that that just leads to more and more imprisonment, more and more sort of problems and suffering. You've been there, you've done that. And you know there are people who have got far more effort than you have, who have honed their willpower to have this strong, focused will. Now athletes, some of these athletes, the way they train, they get up so early in the morning, they do so many laps, and they so many weights. They put forth so much effort, especially these Olympic athletes. They're totally out of their mind, they're stupid, they're crazy. But they get just a few of them who get the sort of the medal. They sort of get some satisfaction. All the rest, and the rest are just in the majority. They get so despondent, so much hard work, they get nothing for it. As for me, I gave up even before you started trying. Now, I did play soccer when I was at school and college. But I gave up playing soccer. The last game of soccer I played, all of my team turned up, 11, and the opposite team, only 9 of them turned up. And it was one of these stupid soccer games with about 5 or 6 nil up at halftime. And so it was such a one-sided match. I went up to my captain at halftime and said, can I play on the other side for the second half? Just so it's a fair game. And he swore at me. He said, of course you can't play for the opposition. I said, why not? I haven't come here to win. I've just come here to enjoy a nice game of soccer. And he swore at me, and I was just so fed up. That was the last game I ever played. Because for me, winning wasn't important. I really enjoyed the game. But not these days. Winning is most important. Getting nimittas and jhanas is more important than just enjoying yourself. We're not here to win. We're here to make peace. Be kind, be gentle. Being a winner is what happens when you put forth that effort to control, to get. So what Ajahn Chah used to say, powerful saying, you meditate not to attain something. You meditate to see how much you can get rid of, how much you can let go. Don't meditate to get nimittas or jhanas. If that's your attitude, you're going to suffer. Meditate to let go. So every moment, what can I let go of? That is the effort you should be putting in. The effort to let go. Not the effort to attain. The effort to see how much you can abandon, relinquish. How much you can make peace. How much you can be kind. How much you can be gentle and patient. That takes a type of effort. But it's a type of effort which doesn't feed the will. Which doesn't make a strong ego. It's a type of effort which makes you more and more peaceful, more and more still, more and more alert, more and more happy. Why? Because you don't get anything at the end. You just have less things and more freedom. So it's the effort to see how much you can let go, how much you can be free. The effort of abandoning. So see if you can do that. Oh, that's that one. Next question. How do we cultivate mindfulness and awareness of our thoughts before they are translated into words or actions, which we will shortly regret? Yeah, how you cultivate mindful awareness of our thoughts if you are, before they translate into words or actions. Duct tape or masking tape is the best. Usually we always carry a huge supply during the retreats, so anyone after 3 days who's talking too much, you can come to my room and we'll put the duct tape around your mouth. We just put a little hole in there so you, through a straw, you can have your lunch and your breakfast, but you won't be able to speak for the rest of the retreat. No, we don't do the duct tape retreat. But mindfulness awareness of our thoughts before they're translated into words or actions. As I was saying this morning, the mindfulness and awareness, it's a hopeless task until you get still. So people try and be mindful, but you just can't do it.
you know, you're trying to be mindful and somebody sort of bumps into you, stupid idiot, you should know better, you're on retreat. It just comes out by habit. You just can't stop yourself. But when you get still, the mindfulness really gets strong, you can actually just receive more. Because for most people, they live in the mist. They live in the darkness. It's like if you go out of here and just go beyond the lit area over here, it's very hard to see. All you can see is by the starlight if you don't have any flashlight. You can still see, but not very easily. And that's like people's mindfulness. Everything is so dark. You can sort of see shapes, but you can't really see them clearly. But as you develop your meditation, the mind gets more and more still. Things go more slowly. Your awareness starts to increase. It brightens up. It wakes up. And then you can start to see so much more. And the whole world of your inner world, about where thoughts come from, and you can see them and they're just about to arise, you can stop them. Because you're really aware. You're really on the ball. So basically, forget about trying to stop the thoughts which go into words and actions yet. Put your effort into stillness. Try and be still. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Until the stillness gets so strong, your mindfulness is very, very strong. And then it's so easy. See something coming up? No, I don't want to follow that. Stop it. It's as easy as that. Because the awareness is very strong. Without the awareness, without the mental vision of seeing what's going on, you're totally out of control. You can't see what's going on. So, of course, you keep hitting yourself when you're walking in the dark. So that's how you cultivate the mindfulness awareness before they translate into words and actions. And when you develop that awareness, in this meditation retreat, you break all those old habits because you see them and you work on them in the retreat. And when you go back home, those old habits are just gone because you've actually dealt with them. When the mind is still, you've got strong mindfulness here on the retreat. That's how it works, folks. Next questions. It was nice to see the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, samaneras and samaneri receiving the dana in order of seniority. Is this how it was done in the time of the Buddha? Usually in the time of the Buddha that the people would go on arms round separately. Even the monks, they wouldn't go together in a line, maybe two or three together at a time, and that was all. So, this is new ground, basically. So, again, that sort of seniority, that's part of the Buddhist teachings, the seniority. But actually how we meld that seniority between the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis, the novices, male and female, we've got a little bit of leeway and freedom. And the freedom we have has to be according to time and place. In other words, we're in 21st century in Australia. So that time and place has to be taken into consideration because the whole reason, they've got all these reasons for the Vinaya, for the rules and regulations. And those reasons, one of the reasons are so it lessens defilements. It gives you an opportunity to keep these rules so your greed and your ill will just are so limited. You can't express your ill will, which means that eventually you just have to get to know it and let it go. And the same as your greed is very little avenue for greed, being a monk, a nun, a novice, male or female. And also, two of the reasons is for the rules of Vinaya. This is why they are there, to establish faith and confidence in the lay community who've got no faith, and to increase the faith of those who already are Buddhists. So what would increase your faith more? If we have the monks going first and getting fatter and fatter and fatter, and the bhikkhunis going last and of all and getting thinner and thinner and thinner because the monks take all the food, there's nothing left for them. And of course, that doesn't, never happens like that because it's too much food for all of us. We all get fat. But even you get fat on this retreat. Did you actually weigh yourself before you came on this retreat? I think you'd be surprised afterwards, even though you don't eat in the evening. Such nice food at lunchtime. You know what happens? You eat a little bit more just in case, don't you? No, you put on weight. You don't need, after a couple of days, you don't need to eat so much. You don't get hungry in the evening. But if it increases people's faith, they feel that this is the way they want to see it, that's the way it should be done. So basically, there's a lot of leeway in those rules for adapting to the time and the place where we live. So we're still experimenting, and that seems to be the right way of doing it. So it's wonderful, we do it that way. So easy. Because that's when you understand where the rules come from, what they're there for. They're for a purpose. So always remember the purpose rather than just the rule. And because that particular rule is not really not so strong, it's respect, mutual respect, but that seems to be giving mutual respect. So you're happy with that, the way we do it? If not, you can always put a complaint. This is not just a question box, it's also a complaints box as well. So you can put your complaints in this box. But, you know, if it's a complaint, I'll read it. I'll just probably throw it in the bin straight away. But if it's words of praise saying what a wonderful monk I am, then I'll read it out. Just joking around. Okay, so that's all the questions from here today. So, any questions from the floor? Wow, you're so enlightened, so quiet. Yeah. Okay, go on, Daniel. You're always good for a question. The Atipi So.
No,
yeah.
Just in general.
Yeah, most of it. Yeah, most of it's from the suttas. Atipi So is from the suttas. Namo Tassa is from the suttas. And obviously the Metta Sutta is from the suttas. So that Metta Sutta has got some really great words in there. To be not demanding in nature. Content and easily satisfied. Are you content and easily satisfied? Or do you still want nimittas? Are you demanding in nature? I'm going to get nimitta. If I don't get nimitta, I'm going to get very angry at Ajahn Brahm. I demand that it works. So there's great sayings in this. So when we chant it, don't just chant it like some sort of parrot. This is what should be done by one who is guilty. Now pay attention to what you're chanting, and it's really good Dhamma. You know, let you do not the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. So you know the wise people. So what you did, would the monks, the nuns reprove you for that? If they would, just don't do it. And just, you know, be, I like the one, contented and easily satisfied. I just meditate for half an hour. That's good enough for me. And even if I just sit here, just with my mind all over the place, I've sat in a hall. I'm just so content to be able to sit in front of a Buddha, in front of, actually, this is, you got the four, you got bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, samaneras, and samaneris. That's really rare, to be in front of the four parts of the Sangha. Wow, you're so lucky. Oh, this is good enough for me. If you like that, you're content and so easily satisfied. Then you get jhanas just so easily. So what some people do is say, okay, I'm going to be content and easily satisfied, content and easily satisfied. Where's the jhana? And of course, that's not being content and easily satisfied, is it? It's just like another game people play. So really be content, really be easily satisfied. So, you know, the breakfast, the lunch. Oh, it's so easy to be content and satisfied with those lunches. But maybe, you know, because they've both all been Western so far, you've had no noodles yet. You know, no sort of Chinese food. So this is really bad. You know, maybe you can try and get sort of a Chinese cook to come next time. Or maybe what some people do, they bring all the noodles, the dried noodles, and they have those in the morning instead of the breakfast. Get your stash, which you keep in your hut. And maybe some of you are already doing that, I don't know. But anyway, just be content and easy satisfied. Look at me. I did 9 years in Thailand. I never got Western food, not once in Thailand. All rotten frogs and snails and stuff like that. And you know, this is a true story. After 7 years, I went to visit my family in England. And you know how I like chips. I was brought up on chips. That's my noodles. That's your rice. And to have real chips, you have this pan with this oil.
you never clean the pan. Because after a while, it builds up, you know, this beautiful covering of sort of grease, which gives it, you know, the perfect flavor. And this is a true story that, you know, I was only 7 years as a monk. I thought, oh, hey, at last, I'll get back to England and have some chips. You know, and I went into my sort of mother's kitchen and I saw the same old chip pan I remember when I was a kid. We kept it. And I thought, great, it's still there. And my mother looked at it and said, I've been meaning to throw this away for a long time. And right in front of me, before she'd even made me any chips, she threw it into the trash can. And I thought, that's karma. Because I wanted it, that's what happens. And she never made me any chips. You know what she made me say? Oh, you know, you must be used to rice. I'll make you some rice. Even you go to the UK and you get rice again. Unfair. You know, I did get chips once on that first trip from a Thai man. He was smart. Anyway, just that's what it's like. So when you really want it, it always goes wrong. So I learned to be just content and easy satisfied, whatever happens. So I'm not demanding in nature. So don't ask for too much. So you're on this retreat, you're just content just to meditate. And just, you know, whatever happens. So if you've come to this retreat saying, right, I'm really going to go for jhanas this time. You know, I've come so many times. This is the one. I really feel good. I've got all the sort of the things in place. I've been at Monastery Bodhinyana for the last few days, just getting prepared. Now I'm going for broke jhanas. Oh, you're stupid. Come on, you've done that so many times before. It does not work that way. But if you're sort of kind and gentle, content and easily satisfied, you're not demanding. You sit here and you don't demand anything of your body or your mind. Then you get peaceful. When you get peaceful, the jhanas come to you. You can't go chasing jhanas. You have to sit still. Be so peaceful, so still. And then the jhanas come looking for you. Don't go chasing them. You just chase them away. Just like, oh, there was an Anagarika here years ago on this property. And he just sat down quietly. And then some emus came. And one of the emus came right up to him and sniffed him. You can't get that close to an emu. But only the emu can come close to you. Just the same way as nimittas and jhanas. Sit still, and these things will come sniff you, and nimitta comes up. And it's beautiful to see, because, you know, the emus are just so scared of human beings, they run away. So that's actually how you come close.
Can you describe the experience of a jhana?
Ah, bliss upon bliss upon bliss. So still, so peaceful. This is actually when nimitta comes up. The nimitta gets brighter and brighter, and more still, more and more power. This is the problem when you get to those stages. The nimitta gets so powerful and so blissful. Sometimes you get excited or you get afraid. You tend to want to interfere with this immense power. But the job is for you just to be so still and just leave it alone. It's that lack of interference, that stilling of the will, has got you all this far. And you just need to continue doing nothing. And the nimitta sort of gets falling into it or envelops you, and you get into an incredible peaceful state. While you're in that state, you don't know really what's going on. Full mindfulness, but you're too still. Too poised, one pointedness, just one thing, just bliss, unmoving. When you come out afterwards, a long time has gone, and you know that something amazing has happened. Now really sort of, these are what they call Uttari Manusa Dhamma. Uttari means beyond, Manusa means human, and Dhamma means experience. These are really, they are supernormal experiences. Well, they are huge, but you know, you can do them. So you know that there's something amazing happened. And then you look back upon what was going on there. And when you only come out, then you can get a good experience of what they are. And first thing is what you're experiencing, what was happening there. Bliss. Bliss not moving. No thinking, no perception of the body. Mind couldn't do anything, still. But blissed out of its head. And the highest happiness you've ever experienced. Way beyond sexual orgasm, way beyond it. Lasted much longer. You come out afterwards and just your mind is just so powerful, so peaceful, but incredible energy. Hindrances have gone, totally. And then you can sort of look back, there's many things you can do. Look back at the jhana, what it was. That's the best thing to do, to get more data from the experience itself, because there's huge amounts of insights possible from there, enlightening insights. That's why, you know, you can just look at a piece of shit in the toilet. Wow. That is so amazing. So lovely. And you really mean it. It just happens. You can't do anything else. Everything looks incredibly. And someone tries to get you upset and angry. It's just impossible. You've just got too much energy. So that's sort of thing what happens. But the deeper the jhana, the more powerful it is. And the different types of bliss which come up. But maybe later on, to give a talk on these things. Even though people feel it's a long way away, it's not that far away at all. And anyway, it inspires people to see that such things are possible. And maybe you do recognize those states, maybe previous lives, because they leave such a deep imprint. They do inspire. Because you have had those ones before. There's something about them you recognize, which is why you're here. Okay, interesting. It's 9 o'clock. So to 40.
Question. For the fruitful monks and nuns, how do you tell whether it lasts for a day or a week or.
The food?
Yes.
Oh, okay, yeah. Oh, this is so complicated. When the number of rules about things which go into a monk's mouth, into a bhikkhuni's mouth, it gets so complicated. So it's usually, if it's something with sugar in it, or honey, what's the other things, or oil or something, you can keep them for 7 days. It gets really complicated. So just offer it to a monk and the monk will tell you what to do. So it really gets complicated, just keeping those rules. And you know, things have to be offered to a monk, again, before they can eat it. And when I was first a monk, I saw this incredible ceremony. And apparently what had happened, a monk had eaten something without it being properly offered. And it was already in his stomach. So he asked this layperson, can you pick me up and offer me to a monk with the food already in my tummy so that the food has actually been offered to a monk, then I'll be okay. That's weird. It's going too far. But I saw that happen and it just really made me laugh. I never forget that. So just keep it easy. Okay. So some of the monks' rules are funny. Okay, so it's 2 minutes past nine now, so the entertainment is over. Now it's a time for peaceful meditation or peaceful sleep. So ask your body, what do you need? Have you got energy? Or do you really need to have a rest? Do you want to go and meditate on the stupa in the starlight under the gaze of the devas? Or do you want to do what we call in our monastery flat out meditation? So ask your body what it needs to do and be kind to it. There's lots of time, so don't need to sort of force it. So remember, be content, easy, satisfied, not demanding in nature. And see what happens. See you tomorrow.